The headlines: Israel releases Palestinian administrative detainee Maher al-Akhras, who was on hunger strike for more than 100 days. The worldwide coronavirus cases surpassed the grim milestone of 60 million with nearly 1.5 million deaths. A new jobless claims in the United States rise for the second consecutive week, raising concerns that a renewed economic downturn is beginning. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital town, this is World News. A Palestinian prisoner who had gone on a long hunger strike has finally been released by the Israeli regime. Maher al-Akhras had been on hunger strike for 103 days in protest at his imprisonment under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. He stopped his hunger strike on November the 6th after Tel Aviv agreed last month to free him. Al-Akhras then said he would spend the rest of his jail term in hospital for treatment until the day he was scheduled to be released. Israeli courts initially refused to order his release despite his deteriorating health conditions and calls by international and legal institutions to stop his administrative detention. The administrative detention is a form of imprisonment without trial or charge, allowing Israel to incarcerate Palestinians. Correspondent Mona Candia says Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras, who was released after more than 100 days of hunger strike, is still suffering from health conditions.
He will remain in hospital for several days because he's still suffering from the conditions he was facing due to the open-ended hunger strike. As you were saying, Israel continues to use administrative detention against Palestinians because they, in a way or another, they know that those Palestinians are activists with and affiliated with some Palestinian resistance groups. However, they don't have really accusations against them in order to force them to quit the affiliation of the Palestinian groups and not to be engaged in any form of resistance. They arrest Palestinians and hold them in Israeli jails under the illegal so-called administrative detention without charge or trial.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the U.S. could never prevent the Islamic Republic from importing technology. Rouhani said sanctions have caused problems but could never hamper Iran's development and progress. He said Iran has constructive interaction in economic fields with the world. Iran has been under a series of sanctions imposed by the U.S. since 2018 when President Donald Trump withdrew Washington from the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran's UN envoy has called on the international community to take immediate action against sanctions and unilateralism, calling them a symbol of crimes against humanity.
Explain the effects of sanctions, let me give an example. While Iran has enough financial resources in certain countries, inhuman U.S. sanctions have prevented us from using them, even for humanitarian trade like medicine and medical equipment needed for curbing the COVID-19.
Speaking at a virtual meeting of the UN Security Council on Wednesday, Majid Takht Ramachi warned of the dire consequences of sanctions, saying they could result in a humanitarian crisis. The Iranian envoy called the sanctions on economic terrorism as well as a collective punishment of the people. He noted that Iran is facing the most crippling sanctions a country has ever experienced. During the meeting, Russia also called unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and the EU illegal, adding that they pose serious threats to international peace and security. Australia has reportedly issued termination notices to at least 10 special forces over a recent report on troops' unlawful killings in Afghanistan. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation says none of the 10 soldiers are among those referred in the report for possible prosecution. It has not identified the 10 soldiers, but says all of them were witnesses or accessories to the unlawful killings. Last week, a report revealed that 19 Australian Special Forces killed at least 39 unarmed Afghan prisoners and civilians between 2005 and 2016. The report sparked an outrage among the Afghan people, who demanded justice for the war crimes committed. They also urged the Afghan government to conduct its own investigation. However, Canberra said last week that the crimes would be dealt with under its own justice system. The number of coronavirus infections has crossed the 60 million mark worldwide, with total deaths standing at more than 1.4 million. According to the Johns Hopkins University tally, the United States tops the list with more than 12.7 million cases and over 260,000 fatalities. Coming second is India, where more than 9 million people have been infected and over 134,000 have died. Brazil has the third highest number of cases at more than 6 million. Over 170,000 have died there. The COVID-19 pandemic continues to take its toll on countries across the world. It has prompted many states to extend or introduce new lockdowns restrictions to tackle the spread of the disease. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take a heavy toll on European countries as the number of fatalities and infections keep rising. Italy registered 722 coronavirus-related deaths in 24 hours. The country's health ministry also reported over 25,000 new cases, taking the total caseload to nearly 1.5 million. The UK posted 696 deaths, the highest since May, and 18,000 new cases. And in Spain, there were 369 new fatalities and over 10,000 new infections. Germany, meanwhile, reported some 19,000 new infections and a record 410 deaths. The country said it will extend its current coronavirus restrictions through early January unless there is a dramatic drop in infections.
The restriction measures implemented on October 28th will stay in place until December 20th for the time being. However, both the government and the German states assume that due to the very high infection numbers, these restrictions will have to remain in place until the beginning of January.
Merkel said, although the exponential rise in infections has come to a halt, the daily cases are still far too high and most intensive care units are still full. She added that there will also be some tightening of the coronavirus restrictions, including on mask wearing and social gatherings. Germany introduced a so-called wave breaker shutdown in early November, closing restaurants and leisure facilities, but leaving schools and shops open. The country has so far registered nearly 1 million coronavirus cases and around 50,000 deaths. The European Commission unveils a strategy designed to make the 27-nation EU less dependent on imports of medical equipment and medication. The bloc has faced major shortages during the COVID-19 pandemic, especially earlier this year, due to its reliance on China for supplies. Jerome Hughes reports.
The coronavirus crisis has highlighted just how vulnerable the EU is when it comes to even the most basic healthcare requirements, such as having enough face masks. The bloc has also had to import ventilators and medication, mostly from China. The European Commission has just unveiled a pharmaceutical strategy aimed at making the EU less dependent.
We do not want to see, never again, the problems that we faced during the first weeks of the pandemic. Never again.
The plan is to ensure essential items are manufactured within the EU. The European Commission is also concerned that EU nations will not be ready to distribute vaccines when they become available in the coming weeks. Just half of the bloc's 27 nations have published plans. Countries are being told to redouble their efforts.
This means that member states cease to have the necessary infrastructure and the logistics, so when there is a safe and effective vaccine, they can roll it out and deploy it as quickly as possible.
Businesses are buckling under the pressure of lockdowns in many EU countries. The run-up to the December and January holiday period is normally their most profitable time. EU leaders continue to squabble over much-needed financial support packages for employers.
We've seen a major shock to the whole of the euro area, major trouble in Spain, in Italy, in other countries. I think the response was too weak.
Officials warn that if COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed too soon, hospitals will be overwhelmed during early 2021. It appears to be an impossible health-economy balancing act for governments. There is concern we are becoming complacent because we know vaccines are coming. Equally, authorities are worried too few of us will take advantage of the scientific breakthrough.
The European Centre for Disease Control says each year hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in the EU refuse to take the seasonal flu vaccine. It begs the question how many of them, and how many people in general, will agree to be injected with a COVID-19 vaccine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Nearly 780,000 Americans filed jobless claims last week as the U.S. is grappling with the coronavirus crisis. The Labor Department said the figure is an increase of 30,000 from the previous week. According to government figures, nearly 20.5 million Americans continue to receive unemployment benefits. The release data has risen concern that a renewed economic downturn is about to begin. It's expected that with the number of infections continuing to rise at an elevated pace, and curbs on business operations intensifying, may also likely increase over the coming weeks. The United States is the world's worst hit country by the pandemic, with nearly 12.8 million infections and over 262,000 fatalities. The states recorded a six-month high figure for fatalities at over 2,400 in 24 hours. U.S. President Donald Trump has announced a pardon for his former national security advisor who admitted lying to the FBI over his contacts with Russia. In a tweet, Trump said Michael Flynn has been granted a full pardon. Flynn's secret contacts with the Russian ambassador to Washington were a key part of a probe into Russia's alleged meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Flynn pleaded guilty in 2017 to misleading the FBI about those contacts. He was fired by Trump less than a month into his administration. In May this year, the Justice Department withdrew its case against Flynn. It said his alleged fabrications to the FBI were not significant. U.S. President Donald Trump says his supporters must work to overturn the results of the presidential election. Trump made the remark during a phone into his supporters in the state of Pennsylvania. He claimed that the election had been rigged to ensure a win for Joe Biden. This comes more than 3 weeks after his Democratic rival was projected the winner of the election by U.S. media. The president has so far refused to concede defeat in the November 3rd election, but has agreed to start the transition. Colin Campbell says U.S. President Donald Trump has a history of saying the vote is rigged whenever he does not like the outcome.
Has a history of saying the vote is rigged whenever he doesn't like the outcome. He said that in 2012 when President Obama beat Mitt Romney back then, when he lost to Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz, in the Iowa caucuses. He said that the vote was rigged against him then. Even when he won the election in 2016, he felt like he had won even more, or at least that's what he said, that he had won by even more than what was being reported. He also did not want to believe that he lost the popular vote. As we know that in the U.S., you don't win by the popular vote, meaning it doesn't mean if you get more votes. It means if you get more votes in the Electoral College. And that's how the president became president. He won the Electoral College, but his rival at the time, Hillary Clinton, won the popular vote. And even then, the president did not want to concede the point that it's possible that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote and he won the Electoral College, which would still make him the president, of course. He did not want to admit that either. And here we have again just a reiteration of the president's usual scheme. And there was an indication there. There was a big telegraph. He had been, and what I mean by telegraph to our viewers is a big tell. I mean, this is something that he had already put out there that he was going to say that the vote was rigged.
Thanksgiving is the second longest holiday in the United States, with only Christmas being more important. However, many Americans are not feeling very festive due to economic disaster, the coronavirus pandemic, and a contested presidential election, which is tearing the country in two. Rami Mazzotti has more from Chicago.
The United States is beginning its long Thanksgiving holiday consumed with divisive and ongoing questions regarding voter fraud in their presidential election. Incumbent Donald Trump refuses to concede, and according to a poll by the anti-Trump magazine The Economist, 90% of his voters agree that Joe Biden did not legitimately win the election. Last-second software upgrades to voter machines in places like Georgia. The unprecedented expansion of mail-in ballots forced by executive gubernatorial orders which were not checked and balanced with a legislative vote. The fraudulent use of mail-in ballots. And other allegations which many are insisting be investigated fully. So far, none of the hundreds of court cases have changed the projected outcome of a Biden victory, but many cases are still ongoing.
Yeah, I think there's some pretty convincing evidence that there is fraud. Could be on one side, could be on both sides, but it would be dumb to believe that there's no fraud at all. If they took it to court and they said that it's fair, then that's what I guess we got to go with. I just want whoever wins, I want it to be who really won. That's all I care about, really.
Massive distrust about the integrity of the U.S. electoral process exists because this is their third disputed election in six tries. The pollster YouGov found that as late as 2018, a whopping 70% of Democrats still believed that Russia tampered with vote tallies in order to help Donald Trump get elected president in 2016. For 3 years, Democrats led investigations of election collusion, which didn't produce a single indictment, much less a conviction. In the year 2000, the Supreme Court ordered Florida to stop counting votes in what was seen as a highly partisan move which undoubtedly disenfranchised black voters disproportionately. The 2020 election chaos is unprecedented, and many feel it will produce long-term cultural changes.
I think it's affecting people because they're really starting to realize that there is institutional change. There's a shift in energy and like power is being lost and gained from other parties. Yeah, we were upset that Bush, some people were upset with Bush won, but I think there was still a privilege that was upheld when he won still, whether it was a favorable or unfavorable win. But now I just feel like it's really hitting like, shit, things are changing. Things are shifting. Like institutions that are no longer serving us are being dismantled.
Record unemployment, which continues to rise. More coronavirus-related lockdowns, which exempt some corporations but not countless vulnerable small businesses, a year full of political violence, and a still disputed presidential election. Many Americans are spending this holiday at home alone and not feeling very thankful. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Thousands of women have taken to the streets of big cities across Latin America to mark the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, decrying gender-based violence and discrimination. Police clash with protesters in the Mexican capital, firing tear gas to disperse them. Some protesters also vandalized buildings and spray-painted walls to show their anger over inequality and violence against women. Official data show that 6 out of every 10 women have suffered some form of violence in the country over the past decade. Hundreds of women also marched through the Colombian capital, Bogota, to voice their anger over gender-based and institutional violence. They say violence against women has decreased during the coronavirus lockdowns.
Every day we are living the violence, and more during this time of confinement, where the violence has become more evident in a deeper way, right? Especially towards women.
Hundreds of Bolivian women also took to the streets of the capital, La Paz. They demanded justice for victims of gender-based crimes. They also accused the current and previous governments of not doing enough to protect women from violence and femicide. Similar protests took place in other cities across the region, including in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Limelight.
Coral reefs, widely considered the most biologically diverse ecosystem in the ocean, help to support over 25% of all marine life. They also provide shoreline protection against hurricanes and tropical storms, an economic benefit through commercial fishing, tourism, and recreation. Unlike years past, when experts credited ocean pollution with worsening coral reefs' outlook, NOAA researchers now name climate change as the primary cause of reef degradation. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Julia Conley, writer, published under a heading, NOAA Research Shows Climate Crisis Primary Cause of 98% of Dead Florida Coral Reef. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. First-of-its-kind federal report on the health of the United States coral reefs finds that, in Florida, the coastal area with the most severe degradation, up to 98% of coral reefs, have been lost due to climate crisis. The study painted an alarming picture, tweeted Jim Ho, director of the Nature Conservancy in Central and Western New York. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, NOAA, worked with the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, UMCES, to assess reefs all over the coastal U.S. and the country's territories, including American Samoa, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, and Guam. The report, which was released recently, is the first to use standardized monitoring data across the U.S. coastal regions. We'll be right back. Jennifer Koss, director of NOAA's Coral Reef Conservation Program, told The Guardian on Wednesday, November 18th, that while the degradation of reefs has in the past been blamed on ocean pollution and water quality, now it's pretty well accepted that it's predominantly climate change. The researchers used data collected from 2012 to 2018 and graded the health of reefs across coastal areas as very good, good, fair, impaired, and critical, with the majority of U.S. reefs falling into the fair category. Florida's reefs were classified as impaired. Ocean warming, overexposure to sunlight, and acidification brought on by the climate crisis and the continued release of carbon dioxide into the environment were named as primary threats to reef health, along with coral disease and fishing. These status reports clearly show the impacts people are having on coral reef ecosystems, said Het Kelsey, director of UMCES Integration and Application Network, in a statement recently. Our work in the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans shows a dire outlook for coral reef ecosystem health from warming ocean waters, fishing, disease, and pollution from the land. Of all of these, climate change is the single biggest threat to shallow water coral reefs in the U.S. and worldwide. The loss of coral reefs has grave implications for biodiversity in the world's oceans, as well as coastal infrastructure and safety and the economic health of coastal areas. Reefs support more than 25% of marine life, providing a habitat for sponges, oysters, clams, crabs, sea urchins, and other species. Florida's reefs are estimated to be worth $8 billion to the state's economy, supporting over 70,000 local jobs in the tourism, commercial fishing, and recreation industries. Researchers involved in the study said their findings should serve as a call to arms for the federal government a year after lawmakers from Florida and Hawaii introduced the Restoring Resilient Reefs Act. The legislation would direct NOAA and Interior Department to provide grants to states to support reef management and restoration. The report by NOAA and UMCES calls for far-reaching climate action to help restore reefs throughout the U.S. coastal regions as well. Local efforts to enhance reef resilience and restore reefs are important to help reefs survive the impacts of human-induced climate change, the report reads. However, those efforts must be coupled with transitioning away from fossil fuels towards more renewable sources of energy. The twin threats of temperature-related bleaching and increased ocean acidification, both caused by climate change, can destroy coral reef ecosystems regardless of their location or proximity to human populations. And along the Florida coast, additional stressors of water pollution, new development, overfishing, and disease outbreaks mean that even remaining coral cover is inadequate and unhealthy. A lot of corals that are left are what we refer to as the more weedy species, says Erin Muller, who specializes in coral health and disease at Moat Marine Lab in Sarasota, Florida. They're resistant to a lot of threats, but they're not the major reef-building species, and they're not the species that are important for high levels of biodiversity. They're functioning at a very different scale than they shouldn't. Potential impacts are not solely environmental. Mueller says Florida's reef is estimated to be worth at least $8 billion to the state economy, providing support for over 70,000 local jobs. A recent U.S. Geological Survey report estimated that coral reefs provide almost $600 million in infrastructure to the peninsula and over $75 million to the Florida Keys every year. In response to the threat of potential future decline, scientists are working to raise awareness and restore coral growth. Past efforts to replant coral reefs have been utilized in response to acute damage like a ship strike or a storm. Now, researchers are using the same knowledge to help preserve the effect climate change has had on reef populations.
Debate. Protests have erupted in France over a new law that has proven controversial. It's over a new security law. The proposed legislation would criminalize the dissemination of images of police officers unless their faces are blurred. Those found guilty would be imprisoned or receive fines. Activists have denounced the law as a violation of press freedom. In this debate, we will ask whether this is the case and whether France is downgrading its definition of freedom.
On Tuesday, the lower house of the French Parliament gave its green light to the global security bill with an overwhelming majority. The law needs to be approved at the Senate and the French Constitutional Court before it can be enacted. It would legalize sharing images of police officers with malicious purposes. It would also require the faces of law enforcement forces be blurred upon publication. However, it grants further freedom to police to record ordinary citizens without their consent. Anyone found guilty of infringement could face a fine of up to €45,000 and 12 months in jail. Supporters of the bill say it protects officers and their families and that it does not undermine freedom. However, those claims have failed to convince others as the legislation has faced a barrage of condemnations and outrage from a wide range of people and organizations. Opponents say the legislation erodes freedom of press. On Wednesday, clashes broke out between security forces and demonstrators protesting the bill in the city of Bordeaux. Thousands of people also rallied across the country, including the capital, Paris, against the proposed legislation.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is, of course, very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Amnesty International has lashed out at Paris for persisting with the bill, saying it sends a worrying message. The European Union has also expressed concern, saying Paris needs to ensure that journalists be able to work freely and in full security. The bloc has warned that it will examine the law to make sure it's in line with EU policies. In today's digital world, it's hard to imagine what would happen if people were stripped of the right to film potential injustices. In May, the publication of a video showing US police brutality against a black man sparked weeks of protests. The officer who killed the unarmed man was charged with second-degree murder and later discharged. Such a brutal incident may have gone unheard if it weren't for a passerby to record it on his mobile phone. The new French law takes away from people their minimal protection against police brutality, their freedom to film violence.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, political analyst and member of the Solidarity and Progress Party, Sébastien Perrimoni, joins us from Paris. We also have journalist and political analyst, Geoffroy Coleman, who also joins us from Paris. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, if I may, Sébastien Perrimoni. Tell us why you think this case is deemed controversial and, as it has been described, a violation of press freedom.
Yes, it's not only the violation of the press freedom, you know, I see that France, which are known as a champion of free speech and of human rights, is now showing a new face. And this face is the face of repression and censorship. So it's a very bad news, not only for the press, but also for the people, as the woman was saying in the demonstration. Because, as you know, we have been a champion, yes, in a freedom of speech and a freedom of press, as we have seen recently with the Mahomet caricature, you know, and the right to blaspheme, as we say in France. So even, you know, what is very strong to understand, that even all the editorial board of the major French channel and the major newspaper, BFM TV, TF1, Le Figaro, Libération, CNews, all the important newspaper and TV channels say that they are against, and they made a publication saying that they are against this Article 24 of the legislation, because it will prohibit them, you know, to cover finally the brutality that is going on around France. So we had the law in France. The law is from 1881, which is the law of freedom of speech and freedom of press. And now we are entering now in 2020, so almost 120 years later, in a new period of censorship and repression and reduction of our liberty.
Okay.
Which is very dangerous.
We're going to expand on that a little bit more, but Joao Coleman, let me ask you this. I mean, to get down to some of the nitty-gritty of this, it is said that this would limit the right to film or photograph on-duty police officers. Now, looking at that, doesn't that pave the way for officers to commit crimes and break the law while being immune to prosecution?
Of course. Yes, of course. I mean, the current restrictions on civil liberties, of course, are technically illegal. We have the right to assembly and the right to walk around and go about our work and about our business without being hassled by police. These are extreme measures which are being imposed, not just in France, but throughout Europe. And they are part of a transition towards a different type of society. The type of society they want to transition towards is a technocracy. And in a technocracy, the individual has no more civil liberties, and he's under 24-hour surveillance by cameras. We already have cameras everywhere in Europe, in every city. And they fear very much that the people will revolt. The restrictions on restaurants, bars, small businesses that have occurred again in the second lockdown mean that an entire class, essentially the middle class, is now becoming bankrupt. And an entire, the motor of the French economy, the motor of every economy in the world, is the middle class, small businesses. They are being destroyed. They fear a social revolt. And of course, they know that if they don't give full powers to the police to repress that using whatever means necessary, the people will film them, and of course that will go into social media. And so they're also trying to crack down on social media. They want to ban social media effectively and make it impossible for people to open up accounts in social media as well. So we're going into a new period of totalitarian control, essentially. And this is what the lockdowns are about. The lockdowns are completely useless in terms of protecting lives. We only have to look at Sweden to see that it has absolutely no impact on people's health. It's detrimental to people's health, mental and physical. It has nothing to do with public health. It is basically a transition to a new society, and that society is a technocracy. And that's very clear if you look at the global picture, if you look at the plans of Davos and the Great Reset. It's very clear if you read Klaus Schwab's book, for example, his recent book, that the kind of society they want is a society where there would be essentially no more society. It would be a technocracy where everything would be online, and of course everything would be under surveillance. I mean, this is where we're at right now. So they fear also in France the consequences of the wide diffusion of a documentary recently, which got 6 million views and was seen by many, many people. They fear, you can hear them on the media talking about this all the time, the danger of conspiracy theories, the danger of thinking that there might be a conspiracy behind the lockdown. And of course, they sense that there will be a major social revolt, and probably a lot worse than the recent Gilets Jaunes. So remember, you had a massive rebellion against the state for over a year in France with the Yellow Vest movement. that was repressed brutally by the police. And I think that they want to be able to repress the next rebellion with even further measures. So I think that's essentially what this is about.
Well, Sebastian, I'm hearing words like repression, totalitarianism, technocracy, social media restrictions, revolt. I mean, isn't France supposed to be a flag bearer of freedom after all? As the French slogan or motto is liberté, égalité, fraternité, French for liberty, equality, and fraternity. So I'm looking at the word liberty now being downgraded, is because that's what people are talking about, the French, in this respect. Is this the case, that this is being endangered?
It's not in danger if we fight. You know, I'm working with Jacques Cheminade, who was three-time candidate for the presidential election in France, and he has denounced for years, since the 1980s, the imposition of what he called a financial fascism. So it's true that if we want to maintain this financial fascism in the world, because we have to impose austerity, you need dictatorial power. So we have done that in South America, we have done that, I mean the West have done that in Africa, pushing and putting in place dictatorial power to impose its austerity policy. So now is the turn of Europe. So of course, if we accept, because we have to fight for this liberty, and we have to fight for this fraternity, if we fight, we can save it. But it's true that if they want to go on with this financial austerity, this financial fascism, they will have to impose more stronger laws, you know, as the one we are seeing today, to control the revolt. Because as the other person mentioned, you know, since 2 years now we have the yellow vest in France, so it's 2 years of demonstration. And from the beginning, you know, the confrontational approach of the government, they decide to have this confrontational approach, I mean repression in the street, was above all to dissuade people and the population to take part at this demonstration. Because at the beginning of the yellow vest, if you remember, we have thousands of people in the street saying, we don't want the privatization of our country, we don't want austerity, we need to have food at the end of the month, so it's not possible anymore. So now we are angry and we want to change the system. So of course you have a revolt against this system, and we are fighting with Jacques Cheminade and Solidarité Progrès, with other countries in the world, fighting to change, to have this new Bretton Woods system, a new financial architecture, because, and it's true, what Emmanuel Barroso was calling the European Union, you know, a non-imperial empire, as he was saying, which is a supranational institution imposing austerity on people. So the people don't want that anymore. They are fighting for that. And I think the question of the commentary was mentioned is quite dangerous, because, of course, half of the documentary is very interesting against the criminal responsibility of the government. But the other half is pushing people, you know, in irrationality and going after, you know, things which are not the real cause of the problem, which is the financial system and this financial oligarchy. So we have to focus, as the Yellow Vest was doing at the beginning, to go back to the monetary sovereignty of our country with a national banking system, with the Glass-Steagall, which means the separation of the bank in France, and of course the possibility to have our own credit system to reinvest in infrastructure, entrepreneurship, development, and so on and so forth. That's the main issue to fight for today.
Okay, well let's zoom in on this word revolt, Gerard Coleman, if we can look at this word and see what's happening. We're looking at a COVID-19 pandemic to have struck, obviously, many parts of the world, Europe no exception, of course, France also. Now, I'm going to ask your reaction to this particular headline, which is very alarming, that came out roughly a week ago. And it said, Europe's governments are losing control of COVID. And because of that, revolt is in the air. And it says that fears of civil unrest are growing as people across the continent no longer trust their leaders to protect them during the crisis. So do you think that maybe the French administration, headed by Macron, is foreseeing something like that perhaps happening? There have been protests in France. We've seen it in Italy, in Naples, where people were just fed up with the lockdowns. And maybe this is a way to make sure that the police is protected, since they are predicting, perhaps,
that there's going to be revolts and protests, so we need the police out on the streets. Do you think this may be the case?
Well, they've certainly lost control of the narrative, the COVID-19 narrative. They've lost control of that, I think, because we now have thousands of scientists and doctors speaking out about it. And the consensus they wanted, the absolute consensus about what it is and how dangerous it is and therefore what they need to do, that has broken down because of alternative media, because of social media. There's been a massive amount of censorship of science during this entire debate, and we've had a monopoly in the media of people linked to pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical interests. And there's a huge pharmaceutical agenda, of course, behind the vaccine, which will make billions of dollars for these big companies. And as your guest said, it is a financial oligarchy after all, and all these companies are linked to finance markets and high finance. So they do fear a rebellion against that. Of course, they won't be able to impose and make obligatory this vaccine, which is a new type of vaccine, extremely dangerous. It hasn't been tested before. They won't be able to impose that very easily. There's a lot of vaccine skepticism in France. And I don't think that in any case, we don't even know what COVID-19 is because it's never actually been isolated. So you cannot possibly vaccinate against something you don't really understand. And there is no need to vaccinate against it anyway, because it only kills people who are very, very old, and they usually die of other diseases as well. It isn't really killing people in the way they say it is. It's mostly people who have comorbidities. So I think, what people fear, I would say, rather than this so-called pandemic, is the measures, the harsh measures that infringe on people's liberty. And, if you fear COVID-19, then by all means wear a mask. If you fear COVID-19, then you should have the possibility of staying in your house forever. Why not? Maybe be able to work from home. But people who don't fear it should be allowed to live it normally. And it should not be prevented from going about their business, and they should not be forced to wear masks and forced to social distance and so on and so forth. And it is these top-down measures, really, which is making life impossible for people. I mean, life has become literally impossible. We now live in a dystopian nightmare. Nothing is open. You're not allowed to do anything, and you're not allowed to say anything. If you have to wear a mask all the time, you can't even have a conversation with people. So this has to stop. This nonsense has to stop. The narrative about COVID-19 is over. It's finished. The so-called pandemic has been over with months, so most of the scientists say. So there is no need to keep this up. But of course, it's not about public health. As I said, the aim of this entire agenda is to move towards a technocracy. And as Thatcher said, society doesn't exist. Society won't exist in a technocracy. The family won't exist, social structures won't exist, social relations won't exist. And they want people in front of screens and iPhones. They want them connected to the Internet of Things, and it will be the big tech which will decide. And eventually it will be people who are savvy in big tech who will be the controllers of society. And of course, high finance is the overall system we're talking about here.
Okay, when it comes to freedom, however, and rights, Sebastian, the French are known to make their voices heard. They're known for demonstrating. I mean, we've seen the French demonstrate throughout time, and they have demonstrated and they have earned the rights that they have fought for so hard. So, if it comes down to their freedom being restricted, if this is one of the levels that the government is going through that perhaps could lead to other things, other restrictions or oppression, don't you think that you're going to have an outburst of people who are going to come out on the streets? I mean, we've seen it with the Yellow Vests, what they have done. Perhaps we're going to see them again coming out and protesting this law. Do you think that is a possibility?
Of course. It's already, going on. You have demonstration yesterday evening, with a lot of brutality, But from both sides, that's also one of the problems, is that big people are becoming violent in both sides, because everybody is angry. The policemen, because they have no money, they are not paid, they have to work 24 hours because you have demonstration all the time, and people who are not self-sufficient economically. So you have kind of, with the disintegration of our economy, by the financial institution. We have a kind of civil war, you know, mass strike ferment in our country, which is very dangerous. So I think for the lockdown, it's not the same issue. Of course, the COVID, we have a lot of mistakes which have been made. You know, for you take Sweden, for example, they are locking people down now because they wanted to not do it at the beginning, so they have to do it now partially. But they so we cannot say that it's fake news all the time, because if you go in the hospital, what I have done in France, you go to the hospital, people are working 24 hours, you know. I mean, at least at the first lockdown, people were working very hard to save life all the time, you know. So the second lockdown was not justified, for sure. But the first one was not a fake news, as we can hear from some scientists. People are really dying. A lot of people have died, not only in France, but in the world. So I think we have to compare what we are saying about this. And I want to say that the problem we have is not this crisis, is the financial disintegration of our system. And with this technocracy, as it was said, to impose financial austerity by all means, with the big pharma, with the GAFAM, with the Silicon Valley, with a mass surveillance system and control of the population. Yes, we have all this problem to fight together.
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, political analyst and member of Solidarity and Progress Party, Sebastian Perimonida from Paris, and journalist and political analyst, Shihua Coleman from Paris also. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Batakhli, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to Heavenly Grief. We are talking about the days of sorrow, these days, the days of the anniversary of the death of Sayyidah Fatima al-Ma'asuma alayhi salam. And we were talking with Sheikh Muhammad on the previous episode, and inshallah ta'ala we'll continue to talk with him about this topic. Sheikh, yes. Assalamu alaikum, thank you for coming.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, thank you for having me. Alhamdulillah for having this chance to talk about Bibi Fatima al-Ma'asuma salallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Now, Sheikh, we cut you off short last time, and we were talking about the saying of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, whoever visits my aunt in Qom, paradise is his.
Yes.
And what I was interpreting from you was that it's not just about visiting a grave or touching the throne, or
yes,
the, of course there wasn't that shrine at that time. It was just a normal grave.
Yes,
it wasn't just reading, saying a couple of words and going back and riding your horse or camel and continuing to your home or your job or whatever.
Yes,
it has a meaning behind it, and that meaning is al-wila li Ali Muhammad, the fellowship, if you could say, mm-hmm, the fellowship of Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. And the reason why you gain paradise is because only a true Shia or a true believer would visit Sayyidah Masuma alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the, how do you say, we say in Arabic, mulazama, or the connection, yes, between, mm-hmm, the two things.
Yes, one of the things that is entailed in that. Mm-hmm. One of the aspects to look at, as you said, is that only those lovers and followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam would do such an act. The other way which Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam have talked about it, it's very strange, also very rewarding, is, for example, when Imam Sadiq alayhi salam wants to count the virtues of pilgrimage for Sayyidah Shuhada sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says those who go on a pilgrimage to visit the shrine of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, غَفَرَ اللَّهُ مِنْ ذَنْبِهِ مَا تَقَدَّمَ وَمَا تَأَخَّرَ. Right? So Imam alayhi salam is basically saying that God will forgive the sins of that person, those sins who have been committed in the past, and those sins which will be committed in the future. So the narrator becomes astonished and asks Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, what does that mean? That if somebody goes to ziyarah and visit the shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, such thing happens for him. So Imam Sadiq sallallahu alayhi clarifies in a very enlightening way that God forgives the sins that you will commit in the future. It means that God will give you the opportunity to ask for forgiveness and to fix yourself.
توفيق المغفرة.
Yes.
توفيق
للاستغفار. That opportunity, that environment that you should be put in terms of a spiritual temperament, right? So this quality of ziyarah is something very much worthy to note and to think about. When I go to ziyarah, what happens for me in terms of taqdirat, in terms of how God is going to plan for me and how it's going to change, how my spirit changes. So this is not a normal sentence that if you go to ziyarah Fatimatul Ma'suma to see the shrine and to supplicate, do whatever which is called ziyarah, God in return will give you the heaven. It's not a normal thing. It means that there are some serious changes going to happen for you when you go to the ziyarah. Yes, if you should be willing for it, yes. For example, you can say some Christian people might come, for example, to ziyarah Fatimatul Ma'suma or Imam Rizal sallallahu alayhi. Some people who don't even believe in Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, they come and receive what they ask, and afterwards they go to the heaven while they are Christian, while they are non-Muslim. No, they cannot go because they themselves are becoming obstacles. God wants to bless them, give them the right path, guide them, but they do not change themselves. Yes, when you are acting as an obstacle and block for yourself, well, that's another case. But normally, ziyarah is something purifying of your soul. It is something that cannot be found in this world. Like, imagine like a river, like an ocean. That when you go through it, when you swim a little bit, you will become free of all the things that have
it cleanses you,
yes. And to be a figure that has this much purifying effect, so when the people come on a pilgrimage and to see your shrine, to be such a figure is so much. It tells so much about that person. So especially in the when we think about the sons of Ahlul Bayt, the daughters of Ahlul Bayt, it means that Fatimatul Ma'asumah
sallallahu alayhi wa sallam also has a high status that really
has a very special standing status, yes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Munshi. Fortunately, we have to take a short break. Brothers and sisters, please stay tuned.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, paradise has 8 doors. And 3 doors of paradise are towards And a woman from my children will die. Her name is Fatima, daughter of Musa alayhi salam. And then Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, because of her shafa'at, our Shias will go to Jannah. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is telling it in advance. My haram and the haram of my children is Qum.
And this one is from Imam al-Ridha salamullah alayhi, that he says, Man zaraha falahu al-Jannah. The Imam says, just merely visiting her is going to result in a person entering paradise. Ayatollah Bahjat, the days that we wanted to see him, you could always find him at a certain time in the Haram of Hadrat Ma'suma. Until his old age, he was like over 80 years old, he would come every single day. Imam Khomeini made sure every day he pays a visit. And some people objected to that. They said, you're a marja, it's not appropriate for a marja to be visiting the haram every day. Once a week, once a month, that's sufficient. You don't need to do so much. Imam Khomeini's response to that is very interesting. He says that you don't know who she is.